What you are. See lights of the self, the hidden part. Stories of women who love women and men that love men. See their side. Hear them out. Don't have a closed mind. Be open before making your decision. See gay liberation. Every family with relatives is involved. Out of the closet and into the streets. Gay liberation.
Hello, you are listening to CHRW 94.9. This show is Queer Review, and CHRW is your cure for corporate radio. I'm here with Professor Miller, the founder of the Pride Library. He teaches the Dante courses at the University of Western Ontario. My name is John, and this is my co-host, Naimi. Hello, Naimi.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm pretty good.
Good. And Professor Miller, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for inviting me, John.
Great. Our first question for you is going to be provided by Naimi.
Okay, Professor Miller, how did the whole Pride Library start with you? Like, where'd you get this idea from and all of it?
That's a simple question, a question of origin, but it has a complicated answer. I'm a professor. Of course, I'm going to give a complicated answer. But I'm going to start actually with a personal reason. I didn't come out of the closet until 1989, after I had been established in my academic career for about a decade and a few years. And like anybody newly sprung from the closet, I was full of energy. And I thought, well, what I should do is have a course on post-Stonewall gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered history. That is to say, history basically of the 60s and 70s and 80s. And so I proposed a course, and it was accepted. And then I went to the Weldon Library just to check out what the resources in the library were. And because there had never been a course with gay and lesbian in the title before, there hadn't really been many acquisitions over the years. And I noticed that the holdings in the HQ 75-76 section of the library were noticeably scant. In fact, I was a little bit appalled at the time. It's not really the library's fault because they order books to correspond to courses that are in the curriculum. No courses in the curriculum, no books on the shelf, or relatively few of them. Mm-hmm. So it was a kind of catch-22 situation. So I thought, well, I'm going to have to supplement what our campus library has. And as a result, I decided to open up my office one afternoon a week. And anyone who wanted to make use of my personal collection of GLBT materials relevant to the course could do so. It's like a little reading room in my office. And so I was able to hire a work study student. That's actually the very modest origins of the Pride Library, both personally and academically in terms of the curriculum. However, there were two other forces actually at work beyond me and beyond the university. Mm-hmm. And one was the great boom in gay and lesbian publication at the end of the 80s through the 90s. If I tried to found a Pride Library in, say, 1972, there would have been some books around, but nothing like there was at the beginning of the 1990s. So the graph in terms of a publication from out queer authors really suddenly started to rise. It's partly a post-Stonewall effect, but partly also a lot of writings were concerned with the AIDS epidemic and efforts to understand the cultural complexity of that massive and still ongoing pandemic. So that was a factor. The books were there. And I would say that also in the community in London itself, something happened that was important. And that was the Halo Club, which was the Homophile Association of London, Ontario. This is an organization that no longer exists, but in the 1990s, it was still very active. And they had assembled quite large archive of social history documents relating to the club and also to, you know, London and region, queer-related events in London and region. And they offered this archive to me, but they didn't want to donate it to my office. So they wanted to donate it to something official at the university. So I approached my dean, the Faculty of Arts and Humanities, and, you know, the proper channels were gone through. And by November 1997, the university administration had agreed to allow me to form a kind of study center, research center in the Faculty of Arts. It was actually called a research facility to help queer scholarship. And because I was officially instituted, I personally was officially instituted as a kind of research center, the Halo Club felt that they could donate their irreplaceable social history documents to what I was then calling the Pride Library. So the Pride Library became instituted in order to preserve the social history documents of the community. So that was a really important factor towards its official establishment in the university. And along with that came a very important donation by a local archivist who had been a member of the Halo Club, but who was also an archivist at the University of Western Ontario, and that was Ed Phelps. Ed Phelps actually phoned me up as I was still teaching my course on post-Stonewall culture, history, politics, and he said, would you like a complete set of the body politic? Now, for your listeners who may not know what the body politic is, it was simply the most important political, intellectual, cultural journal printed in Canada for queer readers and by queer authors through the 1970s into the middle of the 80s, just sort of the leading GLBT journal. And to have a complete run of it was remarkable, since it's been out of print since the mid-80s. So I said, yes, indeed. And so we suddenly had a periodical section beginning to grow, an archive that was really, I think, even then quite impressive for a mid-sized city. And then a collection of books, which had started with my original seed donation of 80 books. And by 1997, thanks also to increase in books from the Halo Club, they had a small lending library that was joined to my 80 books. We had about 300 books by the turn of the 21st century. That initial seed grant from me and from the community at large had grown to 2,000 books. So the idea of the Pride Library had really, I think, just hit a period in, you know, local queer history and then publishing history, and corresponding to major changes in Canadian legal history around queer visibility, to really have been founded right at the right time. So I think the good timing was a factor too, that I can't take any credit for that.
Great. So you have a space. This, now, it branched off into the Weldon Library, which is at the University of Western Ontario's campus, and there's a part of it that is just for you, just for the Pride Library. It's a room, and it's on the main floor, and on the left side of the library. What is in this space, and how did this? What does it offer as a library as well?
Well, I'm very glad you've asked about space, because that's been an aspect of the library very important to me right from the beginning. So I want to do a little bit of history of the space of the Pride Library. It actually, as I say, originally began in my office, but my office was fairly large. I had the first slit window office in University College Tower. You know, when you're going across the bridge and looking up the hill at that medieval tower, that was where the Pride Library originally went. It felt very fortified, as if barbarians, if they ever attacked University College, the Pride Library would be safe in the tower. We were there for 2 years and then moved into a seminar room and two offices in the Modern Languages Annex in University College. That was a bigger space, but it was really quite out of the way, and people had a great deal of difficulty finding it. Then when the library system, university library system, very generously opened up their catalog to us, so we were virtually integrated into the online public access catalog, movement was put in place to make the Pride Library much more accessible and much more visible, just in terms of the geography of the campus. And so in 2004, the Associate Dean of Arts came to my office at the Pride Library when it was still a university college and said, look, we're really thinking of moving you. We want to show you where we think the Pride Library ought to be. I thought it might be some basement office way down Western Road, hidden away, marginalized. I was expecting the worst. So you can imagine my complete surprise, amazement, and delight when the Associate Dean took me over to the main floor of the Weldon Library. And as you said, we actually occupy a kind of pod that extends out from the main floor off the large study area. I always tell people when they go into the main door of the Weldon, if they go through the main door and start hanging a left and go as far left both geographically and politically as possible, they'll find the Pride Library glowing in the distance.
There's videos, there's reference material, there's entire books of what they would call pulp fiction. What is your favorite, what is the gem for you in the library?
Oh, well, you've really suggested the diversification of our collection. So in effect, I think you have two questions that you're firing at me. First
sure.
of all, what are the contents of the collection and what's my favorite part of it? Well, I must say that from the start, I decided that the Pride Library wouldn't only collect very scholarly books, that it was important to have the widest range of queer materials, publications, and audiovisual items. From the most arcanely theoretical and political, all the way, you know, the sort of books that you would read in advanced graduate school, all the way to the most popular kinds of fiction, even underground censored materials that you wouldn't ordinarily find even in a, you know, public library, made very accessible.
Like what, for instance?
Well, we have a considerable collection of erotica, partly because queer cultures are erotic cultures, and I've felt that if we didn't collect erotica, these samplings of it, that would in some way or another be a dishonest reflection of what sexual diversity means, not simply as an identity, but as a practice. And our donors over the years have often presented us with extraordinary works of historical erotica going right back to the early 19th century. And so I thought it was very important to have both analytical works and then works of the imagination. Works that came from the distant past, for instance, classical texts that are significant, texts that show a geographical diversification because queer cultures are now asserting their visibility all around the world. I, for instance, have been building up a South Asian queer collection with my own researches on India. Also works that represented the fullest spectrum of sexualities. Now, originally, the 80 books that I donated to my own little Pride library in my office were the ones that came out of my own reading experience. So they were largely gay fiction, works relating to the AIDS epidemic, and some works on gay history and post-Stonewall culture. But I was quickly amazed at how many other different sexual minorities wanted their literatures and their nonfiction works to be represented in the library. And so our donor base really, really expanded. And now we have a trans section. We have a very, very large representation of lesbian works of fiction and nonfiction. The London Bisexual Network wanted us to have as much bisexual material on hand as we could. And I'm very glad in retrospect that we named the library the Pride Library and not the Gay Pride Library or the GLBTQ Library, because one never knows when a new sexual minority group that has come into visibility will assert itself. So one day I was in the library and a man came in, a sort of distinguished older-looking man. He seemed professorial, and it turned out he was. He was a professor from the East Coast visiting Western, and he wanted to see our collection of books on eunuchs. And I said, well, I don't think we've ever had any books donated either by eunuchs or about eunuchs. And then he said, well, I'm a eunuch. In fact, it was because of prostate cancer and, pharmaceutical effects on his system. And he was trying to retrace the culture and history of eunuchs. And I said, well, look, we really obviously ought to, to have some representation of that. So there's an example of an unexpected sexual minority coming into visibility, articulating its desire for representation in the library, and we respond as a result. Now, your second question, which is which part of the library is my favorite, I would have to say that I really have two favorites, and they're connected. I'm very, very interested in sexology of the late 19th and early 20th century. And our special collections has now a remarkable series of sex manuals from the 20s and 30s and sexological texts. Now, that's reflecting my own specialized scholarly interests, partly because these texts are full of homophobic discourses that are often not recognized at the time. And our special collections area, housed in some beautiful old oak cabinets donated by the Weldon Library, has a collection, a larger collection actually, of what I call homophobic classics. And you might not think that an out gay man would be very interested in reading homophobia, but I actually find this material, including the earlier sex manuals, just fascinating, partly because it reflects some of the origins of the attitudes of my own parents' generation that's the pre-Stonewall generation to gays and lesbians. So I'd have to say special collections with the sexological and homophobic classics collection. Then connected is another specialized collection, which I call the closet collection, and that's housed in special glass cabinets that are painted purple just behind the main circulating stacks. These contain about 1,200 gay pulp novels from the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. Actually, I think there's a few even going into the early 80s. Now, this is a highly specialized collection that usually doesn't appear in university libraries, and yet represents a kind of underground stream of gay writings, both homophobic, interestingly, and very homoerotic and proto-gay positive, sort of homophile would be the earlier term for it. And they have a very interesting history. They were actually collected at the time by a local London man who kept them, and he died in the mid-80s, and the collection kind of was boxed up and was left kind of, no one would read the books. They were kind of left in a basement, effectively. When the house containing this collection was to be sold, the new owner opened the boxes, saw this remarkable, it was a bit like opening King Tut's tomb and discovering, this amazing trove of ephemera from a distant era. And he phoned me up and asked me whether I'd be interested in having them for the Pride Library. Well, I was so excited because it really represents one pre-Stonewall gay man's reading preserved for us, and a local man too, so not somebody from wherever, but from a major queer neighborhood or center, but right here in town. So those two things, the homophobic classics and the sexological collection and the closet library, I would say, are my favorite parts of the real gems of this collection.
How inaccessible was those types of writings over, let's say, your lifetime?
In my lifetime, well, let me
put it... Or from when they were even printed.
Well, I will say this about any gay materials, whether they were erotic or not erotic. When I was in my adolescence, you couldn't go into a bookstore and buy an out gay book or a nonfiction book on queer cultures around the world or a gay and lesbian cultural history text. You just couldn't.
Why not?
Well, they hadn't been written. They hadn't been written. Nor would mainstream bookstores have sold them to the public. to get such materials at all, you would have had to go to Europe, to very, you know, certain very specialized publishing houses, say in Switzerland or Berlin. And so it was, you know, it just, the materials simply weren't available. It was like one was encountering a great silence in the world of print. And worse than that, if there wasn't silence, there was homophobic misconceptions. So I remember as, I think I must have been at 9 or 10, creeping to a public library and looking up homosexuality in an encyclopedia. I think this is a fairly common kind of event, you know, early. You want to read about what you fear you might be. Well, I was fearing I might be gay, and so I went and read this encyclopedia article, and of course it's full of the most homophobic discourse that only made me feel worse. I know in retrospect that the particular account I read was deeply influenced by Freudian psychoanalysis, which has come under considerable, you know, justifiable criticism over the last few decades. But at the time, it was kind of the reigning discourse on, say, the origin of gay identity formation. And it's now largely dismissed and discounted. It's kind of historically interesting now more than anything. But at the time, in an encyclopedia, when you're 10 or 11, you don't know what it seems like. It's information being authoritatively delivered to you. So I get great joy at the thought of the Pride Library existing now, and so that anybody with a question, such as my little humble question, like "Who am I?" not that that's always an easy question to answer. You know, somebody with a question like that can go in and find not one answer, not two answers, but a wide range of answers, historically nuanced, critically, you know, upfront in terms of the position of the author, full of, you know, kind of energy that comes from cultures that have broken through only in the last few decades, all of which was still very much under the pall of censorship when I was growing up.
How has, well, in relation to other libraries, how different is this library focused on sexuality or LGBT issues?
Oh, yeah. So you're asking about the uniqueness of the Pride
Yes,
library.
How
well,
unique
that's a
is
good
it
question.
Exactly?
I often reflect on that because, you know, some people come into the library and ask me, why do you have to have these books separate from the main collection? Why can't they just be distributed through the shelves? And I always say that, you know, that again, the space is important, so that even if you don't read a single book in the Pride Library, you can come in and see the works of our people, our peoples around the world and through history and so on. So it has, I think, an impact on the space to see our books gathered together rather than distributed around. Especially since this is a kind of literature that has struggled for centuries to be heard. And so I think it's important, just in terms of amping up its volume, to bring it all together. And then I also say, well, it is integrated into the library. It's virtually integrated into the catalog. Now, in terms of uniqueness, the Pride Library was the first of its kind at a Canadian university. I can say that, and I believe it still is. There certainly are collections of queer materials in you know, GLBT club resource centers. There certainly are sizable collections of materials in other university libraries. But I think it's really here that you have a space specifically designated for queer studies. And that's unusual in Canada. Now, there are queer libraries elsewhere in the world. For instance, in the Amsterdam Public Library, there's an amazing collection called HomoDoc, which is basically the Pride Library idea on the other side of the Atlantic. And I took a lot of inspiration from HomoDoc because it actually began, their collection actually began at the end of the 1940s. So they have, I think, possibly the largest collection of queer titles of any comparable library on earth. I also think that at certain American universities like New York University and the University of San Francisco, there are, and actually University of Toronto has a sexual diversity program resource center that is now sizable. So, you know, there is a sense in which the Pride Library idea is best served when it's shared. So I often get emails from or inquiries from American institutions and European ones, and even ones as far afield as India, on how I set it up and could such a library be set up in other universities. And I always give a lot of encouragement. I like the idea of Pride Libraries springing up all over the place. And to that end, I'd like to help libraries that are struggling to get off the ground and are really establishing themselves. There's a resource center in Guelph, Ontario, called Out on the Shelves. And I like to take the duplicate donations. We often now, with our collection reaching about 10,000, we often get duplicates of books we already have. So I save them all up, and I like to give them to new Pride libraries to help them along, the way I was helped along by various organizations like the Canadian Lesbian and Gay Archives in Toronto. So the uniqueness is partly the institutional continuity of the Pride Library. We are connected with the university, so the continuity of the university is somehow something we can participate in and share. But I think beyond that, we're unique to in that we collect not only gay materials, as I said, but also what I like to think of as the works of the enemy. So our homophobic collection is very unusual. I know this for a fact because last summer I was invited to give a paper at the Society of American Archivists at their annual conference. They contacted me and said they wanted to hear about the homophobic classics collection at the Pride Library, which they'd read about on the internet. And so I went, and I thought there would be maybe two or three people who would attend my session, my paper. It turned out there were like 150 people.
Anyone wants to get involved with the library, is it possible for them to, and how would they go about doing that?
It's very easy to volunteer. You just contact me at my university email address, jmiller@uwo.ca. And I forward the "I want to be a volunteer" message to our volunteer coordinator.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Professor Miller, for coming in today. You're listening to CHRW 94.9 Queer Review. And my name is John, my co-host is Naimi. And thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on the show.